Mr. Berry, I'd like to make two points I made earlier. The first one is that Judge Sparks regrets that he will not be here this morning. However, he will be listening to the oral argument, and he will be fully involved in the decision-making process in this case. And secondly, because this is a TJAG-certified case, the government will argue first. So, Captain Bobowski, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? And Captain Itner, are you prepared to argue on behalf of Appalee? Very well, then. Please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Andrew Bobowski, and I, along with my co-counsel, Colonel Richard Guarini, represent the United States. Your Honor, I respectfully request to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. The Army Corps erred when they permitted Appalee to use the plea bargaining process as a shield at the trial court and a sword upon appellate review to strike at a material term of their plea agreement. In so doing, the CCA unnecessarily pitted Article 66 and Article 53 Alpha in direct conflict with one another. As used by the Army Corps in this case, Appalee was able to use Article 66 to supersede and erode the binding nature of Article 53 Alpha and ultimately circumvent the convening authority to renegotiate his deal on appeal. When two statutes appear to conflict with one another, courts should not interpret either in a manner which would render another provision superfluous. Courts have an obligation to provide harmony to the statutory scheme provided to them by Congress. Today, we are asking this court to provide that guidance and harmony to a CCA's Article 66 review powers in the context of a fully negotiated plea. It is the government's position that barring exceptional circumstances, a CCA should not be permitted to grant an appellant relief from a material term of a deal which they bargained for and agreed to with the convening authority.
Now, can I just jump back to something you just said? You said that it should not be permitted to circumvent the binding nature of Article 53A. So with 53A, it says that a plea agreement is binding as to, quote, the parties and the court-martial. Doesn't say anything about the CCA. So where is the circumventing happening here?
Yes, Your Honor. The circumventing is that in order there's a intention by Congress to allow a specific accused to enter into a deal with a convening authority. In order for that binding nature of the deal to have any weight on appellate review, the interpretation of that statute, which the government is arguing for here today, is what would be needed to effectuate the congressional intent of Congress. The same way that if there was a term barring the government from subsequent prosecutions of known misconduct at the time that a guilty plea is entered, there would be an enforcement mechanism if the government were to prefer other charges based off known misconduct, the same way that that should be enforced upon an appellant here. And this is similarly something that the Army Court themselves, en banc, and U.S. v. Abdullah had stated themselves. They had ruled in the context of 160 days of post-trial delay that while maintaining allowing an appellant to maintain the benefit of the bargain that they had achieved and then subsequently dismissing the bad conduct discharge on appeal, that would, in their own words, erode the binding terms of the agreement. And they went so far as to qualify in that en banc decision that they would have been an abuse of discretion for the Army Corps to engage in that act there, Your Honor.
So am I being unfair in my characterization that you're saying the plain language doesn't say what you want it to say, that you want us to incorporate into the plain language the intent of Congress?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that despite the broad authority that's granted in Article 66, we should say, despite this language, we're going to find something else.
Your Honor, that it appears from the passing of Article 53 Alpha that this is the intent of Congress and that this is what would be needed to effectuate that intent, to have the ability to bargain for a specifically negotiated plea, whereas that was previously not something that courts had the ability to do.
Why would we go down that path when we have held that CCAs aren't even bound in the context of congressionally mandated mandatory sentences?
Yes,
so,
sir.
It's the government's position that we don't need to revisit that authority. But even though Congress doesn't get to decide, we're going to say, but you are bound, despite any the lack of any direct language that says this, CCAs are going to be bound by an agreement between an accused and a convening authority.
Yes, Your Honor. So to differentiate this between the mandatory minimums is that Article 53 Alpha specifically states that the parties shall be bound, not just the court-martial. And to go one step further, under the previous scheme for plea agreements, there was a need to put on aggravation in every case to show that to get the appropriate sentence. Here, as this Court has pointed out, that oftentimes the most appropriate sentence for an individual accused is the one that they bargain for and propose themselves. There's simply many factors that don't make it into an appellate record of trial that make it incredibly difficult for an Army court to provide a full sentence appropriateness review. There's aggravating factors that don't make it into trial or into a fully negotiated guilty plea. There are victim preferences that don't make it into a negotiated plea. There's also the individual preferences of the accused to avoid the uncertainties and the anxieties of trial. All of those are factors which the parties knew at the time they entered the plea, the court-martial could observe in real time at the time they accepted the plea, and that don't make it into the appellate record of trial, and which would differentiate this between mandatory minimum, as Your Honor has pointed out, and here. The facts as they played out in this case and as they would play out in similar cases going forward, well, we're not arguing that they're waiving appellate review of the appropriateness of their sentence. They are here akin to waiver, where the appellant knew that at least two individuals had been granted immunity to testify against him, where he knew that those two individuals were not receiving a punitive discharge. He knew and he was advised of the rights and the benefits that he was losing by having a bad conduct discharge, and he accepted those anyways. He knowing and voluntarily entered that plea, and then on appeal, when the aggravation had not been put against him, argued against the appropriateness of his sentence, Your Honor.
So, counsel, if we were to agree with the government's position, wouldn't the court be contravening the CCA's awesome in plenary sentence appropriateness authority?
No, I do not believe so, in part because prior to the decision in Armsbury, the Army Court appeared to agree with what I'm arguing here today, specifically in U.S. v. Abdullah and U.S. v. Hunter, where they specifically said it would be an abuse of their discretion to grant the relief from a specifically negotiated bargain for mandatory term of their deal while allowing them to maintain the rest of their bargain. So imposing their own case law to keep their scope of review in balance. And those are cases that we cited in our brief that the Army Corps, to show that they clearly erred in this specific case, they didn't cite or analyze those cases specifically there either, Your Honor.
Counsel, what about the President? Could the President still pardon?
Yes, Your Honor.
But what's the difference?
Is
he not bound to the bargain?
No, Your Honor. I believe that the ability to pardon stems outside the plain statutory guardrails that are in place, Your Honor.
And what about the convening authority, right? This is not a covered offense, so the findings and the sentence go back to the convening authority for action. Is he stripped? He's arguably a party, right? Is he stripped of his clemency authority under the government's theory? Does he have no choice? He has to take no action?
The difference there, Your Honor, would be that in this specific case, he's a party to...
Under your interpretation of Article 53, hey, he'd be bound, right? He's a party or a court-martial, or the court-martial. So he, under your theory, the government's position is that in plea bargain cases, convening authorities are stripped of their review authority in non-covered offenses.
Your Honor, I believe here the distinction would be that these are acts of clemency and not a way where the government would be incurring some form of benefit while running an end around the court.
And how do we make that distinction?
Your Honor, I think that this is specifically that those are other avenues provided by Congress and provided by the UCMJ to grant clemency to an individual accused, in part by the parties who are bound by the agreement. Whereas here, and as I mentioned, the CCA, while not a party to the individual agreement, is also unaware of many of the other circumstances that would have led to this specific deal being negotiated in the first place.
This seems odd that we would say the CCA was bound by these agreements, but that the convening authority, who's much closer to the proceedings than the CCA is bound, is not bound.
Your Honor, the convening authority is bound by all the other terms of the deal. Certainly, if the military judge had made a recommendation for clemency in approving the findings and sentence, that's something the convening authority could have acted on. However, in this specific case, the military judge did not make a recommendation for clemency, in part because defendant's counsel specifically bargained for, asked for, and then on sentencing said that a bad conduct discharge was appropriate. So there was a meeting of the minds of all the individuals who had viewed the circumstances that arose to this court-martial that a bad conduct discharge was appropriate. It was only in the absence of the proximity to those facts that the CCA made this determination on their own, even from their poorly situated vantage point in a case where there was a specifically negotiated deal, Your Honor.
So counsel, I want to be clear then. Is the government challenging the CCA's sentence disparity analysis, or is the government challenging the CCA's authority to do this, period, under their sentence appropriateness authority? I'm not clear which.
Yes, Your Honor, the CCA did this under a highly disparate sentence analysis, which is just a subset of sentence appropriateness. We believe that our argument, although narrowly tailored in this case to the sentence disparity argument, could also apply to a sentence appropriateness analysis, Your Honor. And this is a further argument based off of this court's ruling in August in U.S. v. Arroyo that oftentimes the most appropriate deal is the one that is specifically negotiated for by the appellant themselves, which leads me to assignment of error number two, Your Honor.
Before you go there, though, based on Judge Johnson's question, so I just want to be clear. Is it your position that if there are two plea agreements, that CCA can never engage in a sentencing disparity analysis or not?
It would be fact-dependent, Your Honor, so that they could. However, in a specific case here where there is a mandatory term of a deal, such as a bad conduct discharge, and a small term of confinement, that it would be, in most cases, inappropriate, barring exceptional circumstances, such as ineffective assistance of counsel, post-trial delay, some type of due process violation. It would be inappropriate for them to alter the negotiated for sentence, Your Honor.
So in your opinion, you want us to tick off all these exceptions and so forth and jump into the middle of all that and tell them this is how you need to exercise your broad sentencing authority, appropriateness review, and sentencing disparity authority?
Your Honor, a opinion that was grounded in U.S. v. Arroyo that spoke of the benefit of the bargain that an individual is able to maintain on going to appellate review after they specifically plead to or negotiate to plead guilty, and then citing factors that could lend for a sentence appropriateness review in this context, such as the post-trial delay. That is what we'd be asking for, Your Honor.
And so we would just be coming up with these points out of thin air? There's nothing in the manual that we would be pointing to?
There's not, Your Honor. However, I believe that the Army Court's opinion in U.S. v. Abdullah that was en banc could serve as a guiding principle.
So then why wouldn't we take the position of you've already figured this out, this is your authority, we're going to get out of your way?
Because the Army Court, Your Honor, specifically said that it would be an abuse of discretion to do exactly what they did here. So there is a need for guidance to the field on this specific issue. Specifically, because the U.S. v. Armsbury has kind of changed the playing field, it can cause confusion to any attorney who is attempting to advise a commander on whether or not a deal will survive appellate review. If this deal was walked into a commander and there's specific terms that have been agreed to by the parties, everybody's in alignment on it, this is essentially an unpredictable result on appellate review after the case has been completed, Your Honor. So in order to provide that predictability to the field, this court's opinion in U.S. v. Arroyo and U.S. v. Abdullah should be applied similarly to this case, Your Honor. And moving to assignment of error number two, I want to highlight for the court the number or the primary way in which the Army Corps abused their discretion, and that was specifically in finding that the severity and long-term effects of a punitive discharge alone made the sentences highly disparate. That finding was clearly erroneous by the Army Corps. It was a determination that was not supported by law, one that was not backed up in fact, and one that was potentially even given the opportunity to be bargained for by the appellee in this specific case. The court made this blanket finding that the bad conduct discharge alone made the sentences highly disparate and substituted their judgment for whether this individual valued potentially a bargain between a felony and a BCD. The court stated that the bad conduct discharge came along with significant adverse stigma, negative impacts to legal rights, employment opportunities, social acceptabilities, and loss of substantial VA benefits. The loss of substantial VA benefits was something that at JA 127, the appellee was specifically advised of, stated he was aware of, and stated that he wanted to move forward with this deal due to the other benefits of the bargain which were afforded to him. The court, in making this analysis, did not weigh at all whether or not there was a difference between the felony conviction of and the appellee in this case. The court did not make a finding in weighing the benefits that come with an honorable or general discharge with the loss of certain constitutional rights that accompany a felony conviction. 18 U.S.C. 3559 states that a Class E felony is any conviction where you have a sentence exposure between 1 and 5 years, and that is what he received the benefit of his bargain for negotiating to a bad conduct discharge in this case, Your Honor. Specifically for this individual accused or appellee, he's a relatively junior soldier. The Army made this blanket finding that a bad conduct discharge made the sentences highly disparate, and in putting that language out there, they substitute their judgment not just for this individual, but other individuals who may come before this court later, although this is an unpublished opinion and may only be used for persuasive authority. The loss of furthermore, Your Honor, the only asking for additional guidance for the field prior to the decision in this case, the most applicable case that the Army Court had decided was in U.S. v. Pleasant, where they specifically said that a bad conduct discharge alone would not per se create a highly disparate sentence. While that was in the context of an officer and enlisted, it was still the most guiding principle for the court to weigh at the time that this opinion was published. Lastly, Your Honor, the Army Court stated that there was a lack of aggravation in the case against appellee in this specific instance. Well, we acknowledge that there was limited aggravation that was put on in this court-martial. It is clear from the court-martial that the victim in this case suffered extreme physical pain, had suffered a TBI, had leakage of cranial fluid and blood from his ears, and was required to be hospitalized. That is all aggravation that goes to my first point that didn't make it into the record of trial in this case, and part of the reason why CCA was poorly situated to appropriately gauge the appropriateness of the sentence on appellate review due to the lack of what was in the case file. Your Honor, I see my time has expired. May I briefly conclude?
Any questions from the bench before Captain concludes? Please conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. We respectfully request that you reverse the decision of the Army Court and remand with appropriate guidance. Thank you.
Thank you. Captain Edner.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. The Army Court did not abuse its discretion in setting aside appellee's bad conduct discharge, and therefore this court should affirm ACCA's decision. Through Article 66, Congress granted broad authority to courts of appeal to review sentences. Contrary to the government's argument, Articles 53 and 66 are not in conflict. Article 53 places limitations on the court-martial, but this does not constrain ACCA's ability to review sentences under Article 66. The government is asking this court to contradict congressional intent and longstanding precedent to substantially limit ACCA's power to review sentences. ACCA did not abuse its discretion, nor was there an obvious miscarriage of justice, and therefore this Court should affirm ACCA's decision to set aside Private Armsbury's bad conduct discharge. Under Article 66, Congress has granted ACCA wide discretion to review sentences for appropriateness. If Congress wanted to limit ACCA's sentence review authority, it could have explicitly done so. And Congress does not repeal by implication. Kelly tells us that. The service court's authority over sentence appropriateness is an awesome plenary de novo power of review. Article 53 and 66 are not in conflict. And again, Kelly has answered the question. Article 53A places limitations on the court-martial and on the parties, but Article 66 is not in conflict with that. That details ACCA's appellate review authority over sentences. Even if ACCA did not correctly conduct its sentence comparison analysis, which it did, sentence comparison is only one factor that ACCA considered in its review of Private Armsbury's sentence for appropriateness. And in its opinion, ACCA discussed 8 additional factors that more than amply justify their decision that Private Armsbury's sentence was inappropriate. ACCA discussed how Private Armsbury was the most junior soldier and that he played the least serious role in an assault compared with 3 other co-actors. And very unique in this
but
case.
Why couldn't those arguments have been fully aired with the convening authority through the trial counsel in terms of coming up with an appropriate plea agreement? In Roach, we have recognized that plea agreements may create disparities. And we have the situation where service members can make their own decisions whether to enter into a plea agreement or not. Why should they then have the ability, after voluntarily choosing to enter a plea agreement, to run up to the CCA and say, now further reduce my sentence? I know I agreed to this, but it's not fair.
Yes, Your Honor. The parties have always contracted with the background of Article 66, and so this case is not unique. Since the inception of Article 66 in the 1950s, parties entering into plea agreements have always contracted with Article 66 in mind. So the appellate review is different than what occurs at the trial level, and the focus here today is ACCA's decision and whether ACCA abused its discretion or whether there was an obvious miscarriage of justice, and there was not, Your Honor. ACCA acted within its statutory authority in setting aside appellant's BCD, and in its sentence appropriateness review, it provided ample justification for why not only was the sentence highly disparate in comparison with, but also in and of itself was not appropriate based on the fact that there was no aggravation evidence that was introduced by the government. There were not different disciplinary histories. So the government has talked a lot about Abdullah today, which is not binding on this court. It is an ACCA decision. And regardless, in Abdullah, there was a very long history of disciplinary issues and misconduct. None of that was ever introduced by the government in this case. Private Armsbury played a minor role in the offense. He was the most junior soldier there. There is objective evidence that ACCA reviewed in their sentence appropriateness review. We have a video of the entire crime from start to finish that makes clear that Private Armsbury was the least culpable, and yet he is the only one who received a bad conduct discharge. As the government points it out, a bad conduct discharge is something that will follow Private Armsbury for the rest of his life. He will lose his VA benefits. He will have a lifelong stigma. And he pled guilty to a lesser offense. Was the NCO. He was the most senior in rank who was there. He kicked and knocked the victim unconscious. And the government today talked about there being leakage of cranial fluid and a TBI. That was in stipulation of fact. That was never brought up by the government in Private Armsbury's trial. As I said before, there was no aggravation evidence that was introduced by the government in this case that would have justified the difference, the disparity between their two sentences. The government has not only not provided any rationale for why these sentences are highly disparate, but it has not addressed any of the eight factors that I mentioned previously as to why ACCA found the sentence objectively to be inappropriate. And there were eight factors that ACCA discussed. They discussed Private Armsbury's status as a young soldier, his intent to help a distraught woman outside of a bar. This is at JA-12, Your Honor. Discussed the attack on a colleague of Private Armsbury that immediately preceded the assault offense, the more serious role that Sark played in the assault, the appellee's observation of violent kick to the victim, the lesser role that Private Armsbury played in the assault, Private Armsbury's plea of guilty to a lesser offense of assault consummated by battery, the lack of injury evidence or any victim impact statement, and the lack of aggravation evidence in sentencing. So the focus today, Your Honor, is did ACCA abuse its discretion or was there an obvious miscarriage of justice? And today the government also talked about Arroyo. In Arroyo, this court remanded based on the fact that the CCA did not conduct a sentence comparison analysis and did not question the underlying decision of ACCA itself. And here we have a very, very much an opposite scenario. We have an extremely detailed, thorough opinion where ACCA lays out its reasoning. It lays out exactly why this sentence is not appropriate and exactly why the sentences between the two soldiers are highly disparate. Private Armsbury was the most junior soldier and he played the least serious role in the assault compared with the three other co-actors, yet he was the only one who received a bad conduct discharge. And pending any questions, I just wanted to discuss a couple of other points that the government brought up today. So,
counsel, I have one. It seems like the government appeals things coming out of plea agreements all the time, right? They get very frustrated with the appellate review process that it undoes their bargain, they undoes settled expectations. They'll tell us that it erodes the government's ability or confidence in entering into plea agreements because they can't be assured that the end result will be what they bargained for when they entered into it. And this is another, you know, I think what motivates their frustration here is that this is another example of that. Because on the appellate review, they can only lose, right? The CCA can't make anything worse. It can't increase the sentence. It can't find you guilty of something you were not found guilty of. But why isn't that a valid concern that the government has in all these cases that they can't really ensure the benefit of the bargain they're getting when they decide to enter into these plea agreements?
Your Honor, looking at the congressional intent behind Article 66, Congress created this because the military justice system is highly decentralized, and they wanted to make sure that there was even-handedness and uniformity in sentencing. So they granted ACCA very broad authority, and ACCA has the ability to look, take a bird's-eye view of a case when we do have very similarly situated parties. They have, you know, they pled guilty at the same forum. Initially, these cases were referred together. They were co-actors in a common crime here. And so unlike at the trial level, an appellate review court, and I believe they talk about it in Lacey and Kelly as well, that we rely on the experience of the ACCA judges who have a wealth of experience and are able to use that experience to take a bird's eye view to look at cases once all of the co-actors have been sentenced. And I believe the government also mentioned that Private Armsbury knew what all of his co-actors had received at the time he pled guilty. That's not true. We know that he pled guilty and had his trial and was sentenced after Private Armsbury. And so the government and the appellee in this case, they're well aware of the background of Article 66, which, again, was created in the 1950s, and up until extremely recently, the language has essentially remained unchanged. If Congress wanted to limit the Article 66 authority of ACCA, they could have specifically put that in Article 53A. They did not. So we have to look at the plain language of the statute in the same way that we have to look at the plain language of the plea agreement itself. The government talked about victim preferences and things that don't make it into the record of trial. An appellate review authority is bound by the record of trial. We're not looking beyond the plain language of the plea agreement, and we're not looking beyond the plain language of the statute itself. Does that answer your question,
yeah,
Your Honor? The government is arguing today that a plea agreement itself essentially eviscerates an appellant's post-trial and appellate rights. We just know, based on Article 53A and RCM 705, that is not correct. The government today talked about Hunter. In Hunter, ACCA set aside a dishonorable discharge, and it modified it, and it made it into a BCD. As I said before, in Abdullah, that case there was a pattern of misconduct by the appellant in this case, and that is what motivated ACCA to say that setting aside the BCD in that particular case was not appropriate. And that's another point I wanted to mention, is that this is a very fact-specific analysis. It's a holistic analysis, and that authority is left to ACCA. They are best able to take that de novo looking at all of the record of trial, watching the video of the crime itself, looking at the stipulations of fact, and being able to take this broad macro-level view to say, are these sentences uniform? Are they fair? Pending any questions, Your Honor, may briefly.
Any questions from the bench? Seeing none, you may conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Army Court did not abuse its discretion in setting aside Private Armsbury's bad conduct discharge, nor was there an obvious miscarriage of justice, and therefore this Court should affirm ACCA's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain Ittner. Captain Bobowski.
Yes, Your Honor, I have 2 points to make on rebuttal. First, in light of U.S. v. Kerr from the Navy Marine Corps Court of Appeals and the cases that have followed, the Navy has repeatedly held that military judges are empowered to decline to accept terms contained in plea agreements that violate public policy, appellate case law, or fail to adhere to basic notions of fundamental fairness. The Navy has repeatedly held that a military judge should be evaluated for an abuse of discretion if they elect to accept a plea deal which is found to be fundamentally unfair on appellate review. The Army Court did not look into whether or not it was abuse of discretion for the Army Court or the trial court to have accepted this deal, and additionally, whether or not there was a claim or whether or not it was ineffective assistance of counsel in this case to have pled their client to a sentence that was found to be inappropriately severe. Secondly, Your Honor, I want to highlight some of the things that my opponent has highlighted, saying that the appellate court has this bird's eye view to examine the appropriateness of a sentence on appellate review. That bird's eye view is substantially obstructed in the context of a fully negotiated guilty plea. The aggravation that did not make it into the record that was in this trial was stuff that could have been strategically excluded or was bargained to be excluded as part of the stipulation of fact. We know from reading stipulation of fact that the injuries that were suffered were not just from the initial blow, but were from the subsequent blows as well. Certainly, the government could have put on evidence of an expert relating to the dangers of subsequent blows to the head and neck area after suffering a TBI, but the government elected not to based off the fact that they had a bad conduct discharge in hand as a material term of their plea agreement. Pending any questions from this court.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
All rise. Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.